Excited Utterance, the Evidence and Proof Podcast, episode 159, Michael Reisinger, the surprising story of Smith v. Rapid Transit. Welcome to Excited Utterance. I'm your host, Alex Nunn, from the Texas A&M University School of Law. Excited Utterance is your podcast for cutting-edge scholarship and developments in the world of evidence and proof. We bring virtual workshops to you throughout the academic year. Joining me on Excited Utterance today is an evidence scholar who really needs no introduction. Of course, I'm talking about Michael Reisinger, the John J. Gibbons Professor of Law Emeritus and the Associate Director of the Last Resort Exoneration Project at the Seton Hall University School of Law. Of course, when I was chatting with Michael, I could have really talked about any of his dozens of articles that have helped shape the evidence literature over the past few decades. But I picked an article, a recent article of Michael's, that's going to be particularly fun for the evidence professors and the evidence scholars, or even those who just remember their evidence class, listening in the audience. Because I talked today with Michael about his recent paper entitled Off the Rails, The Surprising Story of Smith v. Rapid Transit, Inc. Now, for those who might not remember Smith v. Rapid Transit off the top of their head, it goes by a separate name in the evidence literature, the Blue Bus Problem. And the blue bus problem is, of course, kind of a legal thought experiment that examines the sufficiency of statistical evidence in establishing liability. The scenario goes something like this. A plaintiff's car is hit by a bus late at night, and the only known detail is that it was a bus. Now, 80% of the buses in town are operated by the Blue Bus Company. The question, therefore, is clear. Can the plaintiff win a civil lawsuit against the Blue Bus Company based solely on the statistical evidence that 80% of the buses in the town are operated by the Blue Bus Company? Now, it seems like every evidence scholar at one point or the other has addressed the Blue Bus problem. I did so in my Vanderbilt Law Review note. Ed, I believe, did so in his Yale Law Journal essay. But all of us have kind of assumed the facts given to us that this case, Smith v. Rapid Transit, actually presents this problem, this statistical dilemma. But in the recent paper that we're going to discuss today, Michael didn't take that scenario as granted. He actually did the hard work, going back, diving into the historical records, diving into the historical archives to try to suss out, is there more information in the Smith v. Rapid Transit case that could have actually solved that case without resorting to statistical evidence? And moreover, should that change our perspective on the sufficiency of statistical evidence? Michael is, of course, a legend in the evidence space, a recipient of the AALS Wigmore Award for a fantastic career in evidence law. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Michael today. Michael, welcome to Excited Utterance.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So today we have a very fun podcast because we're talking about what I think it's probably fair to say is a favorite topic among evidence scholars, the infamous Blue Bus Problem based on the case Smith v. Rapid Transit. So I want to start, Michael, though, at the very beginning with just kind of the basics. Remind us, what is that case, Smith v. Rapid Transit, about?
Well, I suppose that's the question. What, in fact, was Smith versus Rapid Transit about? My journey of discovery concerning that question covered more than 50 years. I first encountered the Rapid Transit case in my Harvard evidence class in 1969. You could hardly avoid the case if you took evidence at that time, since every leading case book took advantage of the remarkable brevity, five short paragraphs, of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court opinion to set it out in its entirety in the section on relevance without much in the way of commentary or notes. Certainly that was the case with the McGuire, Weinstein, Chadbourne, and Mansfield casebook. I remember reading the case and being vaguely troubled by the opinion. It seemed to be a very thin and unsatisfactory account of the human episode involved. One phrase in particular from the opinion always stood out to me. The court recited that, quote, there was another bus line in operation in Winthrop at that time, but not on Main Street, close quote. At that time, struck me as highly ambiguous. It struck me that there was clearly more than met the eye here, but what it was, I did not know. And that is more or less how I taught the case from successor editions of that casebook from the beginning of my teaching career in 1973 to the mid-1980s. Then a 1985 telephone conversation with Neil Cohen sharpened my views considerably. We were discussing Neil's brilliant contribution to what is regarded as a wellspring symposium in the BU Law Review on the issues of statistical proof and the preponderance standard of sufficiency in civil cases. In our conversation, Neil pointed out to me, as an aside, while discussing the Smith case, the incredible oddity of the physical layout of Winthrop, Massachusetts. Winthrop was and is functionally an island just east of East Boston, with only two roads allowing vehicular access, one across a bridge from East Boston and the other all the way across town by a road entering from the north over what was essentially an isthmus. These facts were, to my mind, potentially very relevant to the supposed presence of non-rapid transit buses at the time and place of the accident, and it became a standard exercise in my evidence classes thereafter to explore the implications of these and similar context facts that impacted the likelihood of non-rapid transit buses at the time and specific place of the accident, such things as the day of the week on which the accident occurred, and other details derivable from the sparse facts given in the opinion. Even with only these context facts, I had convinced myself that the likelihood of a non-rapid transit bus being involved in the accident was low. But without the search engines and database resources of the 21st century, there was little more that could be done. I tucked the problem away for some future time.
Well, let me pick up right there, because if I remember correctly, I think in previous research you might have done, maybe back in 2005, I think, from reading your paper, you actually looked into the various bus companies that might have been responsible for the accident. So what did that initial research yield?
Well, in 2005, after the first volume of the Law Story series, specifically Property Stories, was published by Foundation Press, I concluded that a volume of evidence stories was likely in the offing and decided to try to tell the real story of Smith versus Rapid Transit, Inc. And to that end, I began reaching out in various ways to elderly people familiar with the local history of Winthrop. And I managed to clarify some important details about the circumstances of Winthrop and its transportation system in February of 1941. The history of transportation in Winthrop turned out to be a fascinating story in itself, and several relatively recent books covered that story. Until 1940, Winthrop had one of the best public transportation arrangements of any small community in Massachusetts. There was a railroad that ran from the terminal for the MBTA connection from East Boston to Boston at Maverick Square, and from that point to Malden, a suburb to the northeast. At one stop in East Boston, the railroad ran a narrow gauge spur that crossed a trestle into Winthrop and ran in a loop serving all of Winthrop, then returning to the East Boston station on the main line via the same trestle. The narrow gauge ran from early in the morning until after midnight the next day. Then in 1940, everything changed. The railroad went bankrupt and liquidated, running its last train in February of 1940. In the transition period from approved liquidation to the last train, Rapid Transit, Inc., agreed to institute bus service to replace the narrow gauge service and began running buses along the route of the former narrow gauge in March of 1940. As to other buses operating in Winthrop, there was one, but barely. It barely entered Winthrop at all. It stopped in Winthrop Highlands in the northeast corner of Winthrop and then turned around and headed back to Malden. Not counting that bus, there were no other buses operating on approved routes in Winthrop except rapid transit buses. But I could not overcome certain roadblocks, and the press of other obligations intervened. And in January of 2006, I shut the drawer on the unfinished project.
Well, I have to say, Michael, I mean, that alone is some really, I think, as you said at the top of that response, fascinating research, really gives insight to the case. And that really constituted the totality of your research, at least until 2022, about 2 years ago. Because what happened then?
Well, in December of 2021, I sent Ron Allen a Christmas card, and he responded by sending me a present. It was a copy of a draft article by Ron and his student and co-author, Christopher Smisiklas, entitled The Law's Aversion to Naked Statistics and Other Mistakes. The article involves an extended consideration of and response to positions taken by David Enoch and co-authors to the effect that the law in America is such that courts are reluctant to base affirmative verdicts on evidence that is purely statistical, and that the intuitive distinction between individual and bare statistical evidence can be found in a large number of court judgments. And as support for these claims, they cite the, quote, seminal case of Smith versus Rapid Transit. Ron had exploded the notion that the Rapid Transit case had anything to do with formal statistical evidence, clothed or otherwise, in a 1986 article which Allen and Smisiklas quoted at length to good effect. Then they go on to attack the proposition that Smith versus Rapid Transit was a, quote, seminal, end quote, decision. And in this, they are also right, since from the decision in Smith in 1945 through 1972, Smith was cited in only 11 reported judicial decisions in the U.S., all but two from Massachusetts, and most references to it being string cites. And it was not widely cited or discussed in the scholarly literature for nearly a quarter century after it was decided. As for any fame it had, through mischaracterization or otherwise, it was, like the members of a certain Hollywood family, more famous for being famous than for any intrinsic merit or accomplishment. Then a line in the Allen and Smisiklas piece dragged me back to the project. What they said about Smith was that it did not involve any statistical evidence or hostility thereto, but merely unreliable evidence, which is insufficient for a reasonable person to conclude that the burden of persuasion had been satisfied. I responded thus. I think you are on soft ground. First, we really don't know what evidence was presented. We have no access to any part of the record. Instead, we have only the characterization by the Supreme Judicial Court. And after many years of reviewing records and other evidence in regard to claims of actual innocence and comparing them to what courts, especially affirming appellate courts, said about the facts, I think I am qualified to say that the stories told by courts, especially affirming appellate courts, about the facts of a case are not always accurate. At any rate, having put my oar in to this extent, I decided to reopen the drawer from 2005 and attempt to discover as much of the missing information as I could using all of the tools of modern databases and search engines now available. And so in January of 2023, I set off again on my voyage of discovery.
Well, I absolutely love this. It's like, you know, they should make this into the next Indiana Jones movie or something, because the hunt for more information about Smith is once again on. So, Michael, where did you begin in this kind of renewed quest?
I decided to discover as much as I could about the persons involved in the Supreme Judicial Court decision, which the decision itself specifies, which included the lawyer for each party, along with his firm, plus the background information for the justices themselves, and also Betty Smith, who was driving east on Main Street in Winthrop, having come from Dorchester in the southern part of Boston. I used Ancestry, FamilySearch, Newspapers.com, Newsbank.com, Yearbooks.com, and other databases. I was able to find obituaries for the named persons involved, except for Betty Smith. And I was also able to fill out the specifics of the weather conditions in both East Boston and Winthrop at the time of the accident. Although the visibility was good, there had been a substantial snowfall a couple of days earlier, and the snow was obviously still on the ground. I spent a considerable amount of time marshaling the known facts to show that the presence of any bus on Main Street in Winthrop at the time and place of the accident, except one operated by Rapid Transit, was vanishingly unlikely. I also took a run at identifying Betty Smith, who was driving from Dorchester at 1 a.m. Not knowing anything more about her, I decided that a reasonable starting point was to assume that she was from Dorchester and to concentrate on identifying plausible candidates from census records and newspapers. After considerable effort, I identified a number of candidates. And there things stood in mid-February of 2022. In 2005, I had tried in a desultory way to determine if there was a record of appeal still in existence, but that effort never got off the ground. In late January of 2022, I gave some thought to renewing that effort. The logistical problems of a travel-impaired and sight-impaired person in his late 70s actually going to Boston in the middle of a pandemic to examine court records in situ seemed insurmountable. But on an off chance, almost a lark really, I dialed the number for the office of the clerk of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. And after a couple of rings, it was answered. The person who answered it was named Mara Looney, and she was the first assistant clerk of the SJC. She listened patiently to my story and then indicated that she would get in touch with storage to see what, if anything, was still in existence. I didn't hear back from her for some weeks, and on February 18th, I made a gentle inquiry about the status of my request. About 2 hours later, Ms. Looney responded. Not only had she found the record on appeal, and the briefs. She had them scanned so that I would not have to come to Boston, and they were attached to the email. I am forever indebted to this dedicated public servant.
I have to say, I think we all are, because if I can continue my Indiana Jones analogy, this is like the Holy Grail that you've discovered. You know, all the information that you receive from these files, you talk about in the paper, it's truly incredible. And I actually want to just try to take each discovery that you made in turn, because there are a few of them. So first, what did you learn about the procedural history of the case?
Well, the amount of information in the documents Ms. Looney sent was mind-boggling. There were pleadings, motion papers, the record of testimony given at a jury trial of the claim against Rapid Transit in early 1944, and other documents, all reproduced in an appendix to the article. Certain odd procedural and substantive arrangements emerged concerning auto tort practice in Massachusetts at the time of the accident and through to the date of the Supreme Judicial Court opinion in very early January of 1945. The rise in interstate motoring in the 1920s had created all sorts of tort liability problems, which various states tried to address in different ways. It is clear that Massachusetts had the most advanced approach in the nation in some important respects. Primary among these, the only mandatory auto insurance requirement for cars registered in Massachusetts, a very short time bar, 1 year, for beginning an auto tort case, and an odd arrangement of courts that required the initial pleading to be brought, in the case of Boston and vicinity, in the Boston Municipal Court, an inferior court of limited jurisdiction, where various preliminary matters were taken care of, and hopefully settlement occurred before the non-settling cases were removed to the Superior Court for such discovery as was allowed, interrogatories to parties only, and for trial. There were a number of other oddities that had to be teased out and mastered to put all this information into context. One oddity of large importance should be noted. The record of testimony at trial was not by verbatim transcript, but by an old-fashioned note of testimony, which recited the substance of the witness's testimony in the third person, often, without giving the question which had elicited the testimony. This was often clear enough, but sometimes created ambiguities which had to be puzzled over to determine what the real import of the testimony was.
So certainly some procedural oddities unearthed there. Let's move to kind of your second major discovery in the paper, which is about Betty Smith herself. She was the plaintiff in the case. So did you learn anything new about Betty Smith?
There was a ton of information about Betty Smith in the documents, most of it very surprising. For starters, plaintiff Betty Smith was not from Dorchester. She was Betty Smith, enumerated in the 1940 census as a widow, age 46, living in Malden, Massachusetts. Some confusion arose over this because after the accident, she presented no driver's license at all, but only an auto registration indicating that her car was registered in Montpelier, Vermont, which was more than 180 miles from Winthrop, giving as her address only a post office box. The 1940 census reflected only six Betty Smiths in Vermont, all under age 22, and none in Montpelier. But why would Betty Smith lie about her residence? That's easy. As indicated above, Massachusetts had a mandatory auto insurance requirement for cars registered in Massachusetts. One way to avoid the requirement would be to register your car in another state, even though you actually lived in Massachusetts. And that apparently was what Betty Smith had done. However she might have rationalized it, Betty Smith later testified at trial that she was, quote, a widow living in Vermont. And when she so testified, she was certainly lying. The police report revealed a slew of other surprising and complicating facts. Betty Smith was not alone in her car as she crossed the bridge into Winthrop and drove down Main Street for a little over a mile. There were three other people in the car: Anna T. Mulligan, née Malone, age 50, who lived in Winthrop Highlands and was a relative by marriage of Betty Smith; Mary E. Fay, née Murphy, age 50, a friend of Anna Mulligan's, who lived in West Winthrop, less than a mile from Mrs. Mulligan; and John Egan, 54, of 224 Lincoln Street, Winthrop, who was a friend of Mrs. Fay. Betty Smith was driving, and the other two women were in the rear seats, Mulligan on the left and Fay on the right, with Egan in the front passenger seat. The next things revealed by the police report are astounding. Betty Smith's car rear-ended a car legally parked next to the snowbank on the right side of Main Street. The owner of the car was James McDonough of Dorchester, who was visiting someone near where his car was parked. He apparently heard the crash and came out to investigate. He was there when the police began taking statements, and he then produced a driver's license and a Massachusetts registration on his car. The rear-end collision was no love tap. It had locked the bumpers of the two cars together. It took police pry bars to separate them. And it had cracked the radiator of Betty Smith's car. By the time the police had pried the cars apart and begun to take statements, all four occupants of the Smith car were out standing in the frigid night. And when asked whether there was any injuries, all said no, including Betty Smith. Betty Smith told police that the accident was her fault and that she would pay for the damage to the McDonough car. Neither she nor anyone else claimed that the McDonough car was parked at an angle with the rear sticking out into the travel lane. And neither Betty Smith nor any of the passengers mentioned a bus having been involved in the accident. So what accounts for all the later litigation? Relying on a web of circumstantial detail, fully recounted in the article, here's my best summary of the events that led up to the crash and then to the subsequent litigation. On February 2nd, 1941, Anna Mulligan's sister Kate, originally Murphy, married name unknown, was very ill at her Dorchester home. Kate was Betty Smith's sister-in-law, married then or previously to Betty Smith's brother. And upon finding out, probably by phone, of the illness, Betty Smith decided to visit her sick sister-in-law. She probably arrived on Saturday, February 3rd, and was thus present when Kate took a sudden turn for the worse and died. Now, funeral arrangements would have to be made and family notifications done. There was a cluster of relatives in Dorchester. Although notifications of Kate's church friends and co-parishioners would be done through the parish, Betty notified Kate's sister, Anna Mulligan, who then made plans to come to Dorchester to attend the funeral mass on Tuesday, February 6th, along with her husband and three young adult children, all of whom lived in the family home in Winthrop. There might have been a viewing of the body in the church in the morning. The funeral mass would normally have been held around noon, give or take, and lasted about an hour, give or take, followed by a gathering in the church hall where the relatives and friends could gather and share memories of the deceased. In short, it was an Irish wake. Mrs. Mulligan's husband and children had business to attend to in Winthrop and did not want to stay for the wake. Betty Smith volunteered that if Anna Mulligan wished to stay in order to wake her sister, that she would drive Mrs. Mulligan back to Winthrop at the conclusion of the events. At some point, Mrs. Mulligan called her friend Mary Fay, perhaps to say that she would be late for something, and learned that Mary Fay was going to visit her friend in East Boston, name of friend not given in record, and Mrs. Mulligan arranged for she and Betty Smith to go to that friend's house and pick up Mrs. Fay later and take her home. When they arrived, Mr. Egan had also dropped in after his work as a compositor at a newspaper printer had ended. So when Betty Smith and Anna Mulligan arrived, there were then five people present: Smith, Mulligan, Fay, Egan, and the unnamed host. This convivial gathering appears to have lasted a few hours. It was getting late, but they were now hungry, or perhaps in need of coffee. And the four of them, Smith, Mulligan, Fay, and Egan, decided to go to the nearby East Boston Howard Johnson's restaurant at 951 Bennington Street. They must have entered fairly late because they stayed until the restaurant closed shortly before 1 when they all got in Betty Smith's car and headed toward Winthrop. All of this raises the question of alcohol consumption. It is vanishingly unlikely that there was not alcohol available at the wake. It is not unlikely that some of it was consumed by Betty Smith and Anna Mulligan, especially Anna, who was not driving and was mourning her sister. The same is true for the gathering at the host's residence. But alcohol or no, Betty Smith and Mrs. Mulligan were certain to have been emotionally and physically exhausted from the events of the day. A short drowsing off by Betty Smith is by far the best explanation for the accident and its details. So what happened to precipitate all the litigation? What about the assertion in the police report of no injuries? Well, that was apparently true or substantially true for the three lucky ducks, Mrs. Mulligan, Mrs. Fay, and Mr. Egan. Or at least they did not suffer sufficient injuries that they ever sought compensation. But it clearly was not true of Betty Smith. It is fairly certain that delayed effects of soft tissue injuries, connective tissue injuries, and other injuries resulted in substantial impairment and pain. One pleading puts it this way, that in consequence of the accident, she sustained severe personal injuries resulting in pain of body and anguish of mind, which caused her to be put to expense for medical care and attendance and made her unable to attend to her usual duties. It should be noted that the $10,000 amount of the original claim for compensation was not an insubstantial sum, amounting to about $180,000 today. So she went from feeling fortunate that she was not charged with anything to feeling the victim whose injuries ought to be paid for by someone who could afford it. And her first target in court was not Rapid Transit. It was Mr. McDonough, the owner of the car she hit. It is easy to see how she might justify this to herself. His car was, well, insured against liability in Massachusetts, and he would suffer no real harm, and his insurance company could surely afford it. So the action against McDonough was the first action she filed in March of 1942. In it, she asserted that his car was parked at an angle and protruding into the street, creating an unsafe condition which caused her injuries. Nothing in this action says anything about a bus being involved. On top of that, the lawyer, Mr. Kingston, was apparently not aware of the fact that the McDonough action was time-barred when filed because of the short statute for the auto tort claim. And this issue was preserved in the response for McDonough by his insurer's lawyer. It became obvious that the McDonough litigation would yield nuisance value at most, and Betty Smith then set her sights on Rapid Transit. An action against Rapid Transit was filed. This action contains the first assertion that a bus was involved in the accident. It was time barred, and again, the defense of time bar was preserved in the response of pleading. But for some reason, this was not ruled on either before or after trial, although it was among the questions presented to the Supreme Judicial Court in Rapid Transit's Supreme Judicial Court filing. When I finally worked through all of this, I considered retitling the article Lies, Damned Lies, and No Statistics, followed by a more specific conclusory statement. But I decided that such a title would be a spoiler that gave away too much at the beginning of the piece. But now, it seems to me, the more specific statement functions well as the conclusion. So, conclusion. There probably was no bus involved in the accident, but if there was such a bus, it was a Rapid Transit bus.
Michael, this has been such an amazing discussion. All the research you've done on Rapid Transit, it's incredible. Any further thoughts that might interest the audience as kind of a parting note?
Yes, actually. I got this idea from an English evidence colleague, Paul Roberts. who read the article when it was published and suggested this idea, which does shine a light on the case from a new angle. Paul pointed out that all the justices of the Supreme Judicial Court knew from the submissions made by Rapid Transit's lawyer that Betty Smith's claim against Rapid Transit was time barred, and that this ground had been preserved as an alternate reason for affirming the result of the case dismissing Betty Smith's claim against Rapid Transit. However, since this ground had for some reason never been ruled upon below, in order to give relief to Rapid Transit on this ground, the Supreme Judicial Court would either have to take some form of judicial notice of the times involved or else remand to the trial court for a ruling on the time bar. Either course must have seemed an unusual step, and in addition, either course implied, on the record, a criticism of the court below. It is well known that many affirming courts are loath to criticize the performance of the court below, as such criticism undermines the collegiality of the judiciary as a whole, as well as potentially undermining respect for the criticized judge. It must have seemed vastly preferable to achieve the end of justice in the individual case simply to affirm the dismissal on the failure of proof ground. However, that choice and the opinion that resulted from it, with its opacity, scant detail, and unnecessary invocation of mathematical odds, has befuddled and confused commentators on the sufficiency of evidence in civil cases for 80 years. Perhaps this new light will help dispel the fog and finally lay Smith versus Rapid Transit to rest.
Well, Michael, that is incredible historic research. This is an evidence puzzle that has been around for decades, as you've noted. We've all kind of wrestled with it. And now, with you unearthing this background, it provides such a cool new perspective, such an interesting historical lens on what actually happened there in Massachusetts. So thank you so much for enlightening us and for coming on Excited Utterance.
Well, you're certainly welcome.
It was a tremendous joy for me personally to be able to interview Michael today about his most recent paper. Of course, the insight that he provides to Smith v. Rapid Transit, and by extension, the Blue Bus problem, it's incredibly valuable. And I think it presents an undeniable variable for those of us considering the Blue Bus problem and the sufficiency of naked statistical evidence. But I was also very honored to be able to interview Michael today because Michael, without knowing it, actually played a central role in my development as an evidence scholar. Back when I was clerking on the DC circuit around 2016, 2017, I caught wind, probably through Ed, of an evidence symposium going on at Seton Hall. And in particular, this was an evidence symposium honoring the career, honoring the achievements and contributions of one Michael Reisinger. So Ed Cheng tells me about this symposium, and he kind of knew that I was interested in a career in the legal academy, specifically evidence, but I was so green at the time. I didn't know anything about the evidence community. I didn't know anything about where the current literature was at, but I thought, great, this is a perfect opportunity. I'll go up to Seton Hall. Ed Cheng can introduce me to a few people, and it will be fantastic. Now, of course, as fate would have it, Ed had his flight canceled at the last second due to an airplane malfunction, so he wasn't able to make it up to New Jersey. So I was like, great. And I remember sitting there the morning of the symposium thinking, should I even attend this symposium? I won't know anyone. I won't really know what's going on. But I thought, I already made the train trek up, so I might as well head to Seton Hall and sit in the very back of the room and see what this symposium is all about. And I remember, over the course of the next few hours, being absolutely blown away as I heard scholar after scholar talk about the contributions of Michael and talk about the impact that he made on the field of evidence law. And I think that moment was one of a couple of moments that I can point to as this kind of central moment in my career when I thought, absolutely, evidence law is for me. And if I'm able to have a career that's even half as impressive as the one that Michael had, that would be a meaningful and worthwhile pursuit. And as I left the symposium that day, I thanked Michael for allowing me to attend, kind of shared my situation, and he offered such warm encouragement, it really sealed the deal. I went home from that symposium, started applying, I think the next week, to fellowships, and as they say, the rest is history. So I owe Michael a sincere debt of gratitude, not only for all that he has done for the field of evidence, but also for what he has done for me personally, perhaps without even knowing it, influencing my career in a significant way. And best of all, I'm sure that my story is just one of many, as Michael has left an indelible impact on the field of evidence law over the past few decades. Support for Excited Utterance is generously provided by Vanderbilt Law School's Brandstetter Litigation and Dispute Resolution Program, as well as the Texas A&M University School of Law. The producer is Ed Chang, and the production editor is Anirudh Barela. Additional assistance was provided by Lexi Creasy, and background music is provided by Kirsten Castle Greer, Felix Wong, and Alex Crew. I'm your host, Alex Nunn, and I hope you'll join us again next time when we take on another work in the world of evidence and proof.